Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Our guest today is Ginny Choi. She's a program director of academic and student programs, a senior fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's the co-author with Virgil Storr of Do Markets Corrupt Our Morals? Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
I guess I'll just start with, well, do they?
I think the short answer to that is no, they don't. And in fact, so we believe that the markets are morally enriching.
Is this a philosophical? I mean, there's a lot of philosophical points that could be made about the connections that are brought. You could make them about, you know, governmental actors and say democracy makes us care about each other, which some people argue, and you could just make a philosophical point. But are you making an empirical point too?
Yes. And our book we were inspired to write the book because we were particularly dissatisfied with the apparent consensus among even the defenders and critics of markets that markets seem to be morally corrupting. And we wrote the book directly responding to that. And one of the things that we also noted as we were going through the literature was that the question, do markets corrupt our morals, is not just a deontological point, right? Like, it's also a question that we could explore looking at existing empirical literature. So that's what we did here.
Before we dive into that, because your book is dense with empirical literature, I'm going to just clarify, this is a book about the impact of markets in a market society on us. So what do you mean by a market society?
Yeah, so generally speaking, when we talk about market societies, the definition that we've been working with are those societies that have that don't embrace the markets and don't have a lot of interventions and other things in place that prohibit the free operation of the market within that society. I get that that definition might seem a little vague for some people, especially when we're trying to, when they're thinking about sort of finding empirical traction using that particular definition, but it is effectively looking at the free operation of markets within society.
So in many Western countries, you have some pretty harsh non-market forces, some of what people might call welfare states, generous welfare states in particular, to be non-market oriented. So will we make a distinction between, say, Denmark and America, or maybe Denmark and Hong Kong in 1985 in terms of how market-based they are?
In order to sort of determine whether a country is what we in the book define as market society or not, we use five different indices to sort of determine that. And what we see is that, at least according to these indices, that places like Denmark that have a large welfare state, and places like the United States that have less of a welfare state, they're both considered to be embracing of markets. And we embrace that too. We think there's different flavors of market societies. I think it's important that whichever version of the market that a particular society has needs to really work with what's with the country that it feels natural to the citizens of that country. So according to our sort of initial sort of look at the indices as we're categorizing different countries into markets versus non-market, we found that both Denmark and United States and similar countries are all considered to be market societies.
You have this quote from an author named McNally in the book that I rather like, that's about the way that markets or market agents get portrayed in our society. And it is a really striking thing. So Nally writes, Tales of body snatching, vampirism, organ theft, and zombie economics all comprise multiple imaginings of the risk to bodily integrity that inhere in a society in which individual survival requires selling our life energies to people on the market. And this is, I mean, it's hyperbolic, but it's common, I suppose. And it does seem to be the case that in so many of our movies and our novels and shows and so on, like the market agents, the businessman or the merchant or the boss are just these absolutely vile, evil people who embody everything that we should try to escape from in our moral character, which is odd in a society that's so dominated by markets. Like, why is this? Why do we have such this kind of complicated and negative view of market actors?
I think it has a lot to do with the experiences that we have, right? Like, it's not, and I think it's, for instance, in recent years, we've seen a lot of bad happening that I think are associated with markets, right? For instance, in the last 20 years alone, we had Enron happen, and we saw Bernie Madoff, make the headlines, find out that his hedge fund it's a Ponzi scheme. The same year, the Great Recession happened. And then we also saw sort of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And then more recently, we now have the anti-work movement, right? During the pandemic, people spent a lot of their energy, dedicated a lot of their time to work to make sure that their businesses, their companies are staying, making it through the pandemic. During that time, they put in more time, they put in more energy to their work with some of the bosses saying, like, look, I know it's a really hard time right now, but once we go back to normal, there will be a reward for all the effort that you put in right now. There will be promotions or there will be bonuses or something, those kinds of rewards as for the efforts that they put in. And once things started returning back to normal, that didn't seem to be the case, at least across the board, right? So you see a lot of workers now either looking for new jobs. They've left. They felt betrayed. They felt let down by their companies, and they're leaving to find others. And over the pandemic, some of them have found that this wasn't the type of career that they wanted. So they're now looking to switch and find careers in other industries and all that. So I think a lot of the negative publicity that market gets is arising from our personal experiences. And while I certainly don't mean to say, like, let's downplay that, like the sense of betrayal that employees feel from their employers, I think that's real. And I never want to say that's something that we should downplay. But those are punctuated moments, I think, where there's a very high level of negative sentiment towards workplaces, towards the market. And in those times, we forget about all the really awesome things that happen on a daily basis, right? For instance, during the pandemic, a lot of communities tried to help out their local businesses. There was, at least in the area that I live in, there was a lot of push for, like, oh my goodness, like, this wonderful restaurant or this wonderful mom and pop store is really struggling over the pandemic. And it's really important to us that this particular restaurant, this particular business remains with us within the community. Let's go spend our money there. Let's not go to Starbucks. Let's not go to Dunkin' Donuts. Let's go to our local coffee shop so that we have so that they too can also survive with us through these pretty difficult times. So, and those are really great moments. I think those are really, I wish those kinds of events actually make the news more often. But I also do understand that the sort of the wave of current events and the incentives behind, what type of events and news get picked up. I totally get all of that, but it's those everyday experiences that I think that people tend to sort of brush aside. And I think we need to keep that in mind.
There's something to this critique, though, because one of the things that you hear from at least anti-capitalists is the idea that, I mean, what value are you to your employer fundamentally? Like, why are you there? When will you be fired? Like, you'll be fired when your contribution value, which is different than our value as a human being, and like equating those two things together, it seems like one of the things capitalism is prone to doing, that you say, this person earned $1 million last year because of what they did, and this person earned $20,000. And so there seems to be something about equating that value, but either way, your employer only has you there. They may be friendly to you. They may ask about your family, but they only have you there as long as you're worth it to them. So isn't that dehumanizing in and of itself?
Yeah. And I, again, that's not something I want, that we want to sort of dismiss, right? Like, I think it is a unfortunate dynamic, I think, as a company or a particular organization grows too big. And I think we all experience this in our own sort of social lives, right? Like, as our network grows and the group of people that we interact with on a regular basis grows, I think the unfortunate part that happens there is some people who are at the periphery become sort of, you know, like, we don't treat them the way we would have treated them had they been closer to us, closer to our core network, when the network, our social networks were smaller. So I think that's an the unfortunate reality in sort of as particular organizations grows that would happen. And I think there's sort of waves of things that happen. And by that, what I mean is, it might just be my impression, but I feel like there've been more large corporations in the past. Again, it might just be my impression, right? Like, this is an empirical question. Like, it's something probably that we would need to look into more carefully. But I think people are actually responding to, I don't want to be another sort of cog or another another tool in the entire machinery. I want to be regarded as a person. I want to be regarded. I want to know the value that I'm bringing to the company and that the company understands that. And I think that sort of what began as an undercurrent, I think it's beginning to rise to the top. And I think especially with the younger generation, I think that's the reason why we see a lot of emphasis on who they're working for. Right? It's one of the things I've noticed, and I think this is really great, is that the generation that's now graduating from college and now entering the workplace, they're very conscious about the employers that they're working for. It's not just the name. It's not just the, for instance, they're not looking at the name and saying, oh, it's Goldman Sachs. They're looking at the company to be like, okay, so what type of company are you? Like, what do you believe in? How do you treat your employees? Those are really important factors for them. And if they feel that they're not being treated right, they go, all right, like, okay, thanks for all the experiences, but you and I are not a good fit. So I'm going to look for a different position to work for now at a different company. And I think I think that's a really great thing, right? Like, I think it's a response to the particular dissatisfaction that you, Trevor, just brought up. And we're now moving, we're kind of swinging back towards sort of that world where employers are beginning to treat their workers better, beginning to treat their workers as valued human beings and who bring really valuable things to the company.
That's an interesting point, because it gets to something that I think a lot of people overlook when in their general perspective of kind of the morality of markets, which is that employers are market participants too. They're not just, and corporations are market participants. They're not just the people providing us with this stuff that then we're, you know, competing with each other to buy or get more of or whatever, but that, like, they are subject to it. And so if we decide that we are going to hold employers to a stronger moral standard, they need us as much as we need them. And so we can start to push them in this more other regarding, respectful direction. And of course, there are lots of good employers, but like the bad ones will be subject to this market force too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. And I think, again, I might be wrong on this, but and like the, what is it? The corporate social responsibility is now a thing, right? And when I was working at St. Vincent College in the business school, I remember picking up a textbook and seeing that there's a section on corporate social responsibility and how that all is an integral part of what makes a successful firm now. And I think it is the case that it feels that employers and companies are these in the moment sort of powerful forces that seem to be felt as immovable, and that one person or a group of employees can't actually change them, or even customers, right? But I think, but you're absolutely right, Aaron. Like these are organizations made up of, people who respond to others' needs within the market. And if they're no longer serving the needs of others in society and in the market sufficiently, then they will sort of ebb out of existence. And if they don't know how to adapt to changing circumstances, changing desires, and changing, the entire atmosphere changing, if they just can't respond to it, then they won't survive.
It seems that an important point here, before getting into kind of the empirical parts of how we're going to measure morality and things like this, it seems that an important point here is compared to what? Like, if you object to hierarchies that objectify you and turn your labor into the sum total of your value as a person, does alternative methods of government and economic systems do a better job of not objectifying you? And I think we can safely say that those who lived in the Soviet Union or in communist China are kind of being objectified in an interesting way, because nations like that tend to objectify their people as inputs into a large national output device. So, you get North Korea, everyone's got to do calisthenics at like 10 and 2 every day because your life is not your own. You're part of a machine. So when we talk about, yes, different hierarchies when someone has power over you sucks, but it kind of is, you have to kind of weigh one against the other and say, well, do these governing institutions make people more moral? Do you get into that in the book in the sense, I mean, the one that is in the philosophical literature, at least, is the deliberative democracy people, the people who very much believe that if we all got together like a homeowners association or something and talked about everything, we become actually better people in the process of deliberating and things like that. So do you kind of do any of that weighing that if markets, maybe there are bad sides to markets, not maybe, there are definitely bad sides to markets, but there are really bad sides to government that need to be weighed against that?
Yeah, so the book is narrowly a response to the criticism that markets are morally corrupting. So when we were thinking about how to respond to that, we narrowly sort of thought about just the markets. In other words, we didn't look at, for instance, democracy more specifically or anything like that. And but nothing that we say in the book says anything about democracy or any other political institution. The response we have is simply on the basis of whether or not a particular society is more embracing or less embracing of markets. And the important, sometimes I wish we made a sort of stronger point on this in the book, and it is that it is incredibly important for whichever economic institution is in place, which whether it's markets or whether it's something else, that it needs to be integrated and supporting and supported by the political institution and the social institution. So if the polity, society, and economy, the institutions that are in place, are not meshing well with one another, if they have core values that are in competition with one another, and I don't know whether that society, or rather that country, works, right? It's while we don't say nothing that in the book says anything about the types of social institutions, the type of political institutions of a particular country, I think it's really important to also note that whichever political institutions in place, for markets to be operating at its best, needs to also be a institution that embraces liberty. And if it's an institution that doesn't embrace liberty, I don't know how an economic institution that embraces liberty at the core, I don't know what that market looks like if the political institutions is about, say, coercion.
I'm going to turn now to some of the common objections to markets, or the common senses that we have about the way that they might corrupt us or make us worse. And we'll start with this one. We're recording this a week before Thanksgiving, which means a week and a day before Black Friday, which has now also come to be known as Buy Nothing Day, according to the internet. And this ties into one of the concerns I think a lot of people have about markets, which is, your book is very good at pointing out the ways that markets make us wealthier and people in markets have longer lifespans and more access to stuff and so on. Like, all of that's good, but that the very nature of a market or of companies in a market is convincing us we want what they are providing and that we're willing to pay for it. And that means convincing us that we never have enough, that we should always have more, and that we should want more than the people next to us, or that status is bound up in how much we have relative. And so all of this turns us into kind of materialistic consumers who are buying lots of things, worrying about what things we are going to buy next or aren't able to buy, working long hours in jobs we don't like in order to buy those things, and that none of this is making us happy, and that all of this is kind of encouraging us to be vicious, or at least not wise about our own well-being. Is there any truth to any of that?
I think it is incredibly hard as human beings achieve a state where we're not envious of one another. And I don't mean it to be sort of pessimistic or anything, but when I was younger, I'm an only child, right? Like, I have no siblings that I'm competing with for anything. And even then I was, I displayed a lot of envy and jealousy about what other kids, my friends, were getting from their parents. And in some sense, that's weird, right? Like, my parents are able to respond to a lot of my needs. In fact, it is my opinion that they spoiled me pretty badly. So I got everything that I wanted, and yet I still had that. And so I think it's keeping up with the Joneses is just something that happens because we live amongst a group of people. And I don't think that's necessarily I might be wrong on this. It's just my, and I just don't have the evidence for it. But my guess is, even if you had a community that had little contact with the market, or the market was not operating in that community, my guess is a type of envy for others will still be in existence. So, and yeah, and I, I'm, I don't know what, you know, like, I don't know if I get that there's a sense of that gets really sort of heightened in times like thanks to Black Friday in the United States, Boxing Day in United Kingdom, and all that. And I totally get that happens. But it's not clear to me that kind of the phenomena that underlies consumerism is, in fact, just is a characteristic that is specific to markets alone.
One of the ways that we can think about what it means to be a moral person is in generally how we treat others and you know what we do or don't do for them. And one of the really striking things reading your book as you're mustering this wealth of empirical data is that when we think about, especially like kind of anti-market people or people on the far left who are like, if we just, you know, if we got rid of markets and we got rid of competition and we all took care of each other, these are the things that would mean. And it would mean like everyone would get a good education and everyone would have enough to eat and everyone would have autonomy and the ability to do, you know, what matters to them, and we wouldn't hurt each other. And then your book is just like whole sections of it are just, here are the instances, like in a market, people have better educations or higher literacy or are more healthy. So it's like we are, whether we're intending to or not, we're treating each other in a more moral way. Could you run through some of that evidence for the ways that we kind of are, our lives are better and we're better at providing in markets?
Yeah, so generally, when we were sort of thinking about how to organize the vast amounts of empirical information that we looked at, the way we thought about it was to to sort of split them up into two different chapters. And so the chapters that I'm referring to is chapter 4 and 5, and originally that chapter was just meant to be one. so it was something that as we were writing, we were like, oh, there's a lot of things going on here and we need to, there's a better way to organize this. And generally speaking, it turns out when we looked at, we went to the data, when we went to the empirical literature, people are not only living better lives because of the market, they are also improving their own lives through the market as well. So as you said, Aaron, there's people in market societies have better education, they live longer lives. In addition, they are able to better take care of themselves. We found that, for instance, they're able to, their spending, their health expenditures in market societies were larger than those in non-market societies. And it's not just expenditure. I think my sense is part of the reason why they're able to spend more is because there's more facilities and more options available to actually address a lot of the health issues that citizens have. In addition, there's all this basic infrastructure that allows citizens in market societies to live better lives, right? So they have more access to clean water. They have more access to internet. They have more access to telephone. They have much more well-developed railways. And these are simply just looking at the data that that was made available to us. Because of how the nature of data collection goes and all of that, like it's, I know that's not a perfect thing, and nowadays, at least for many of us in the U.S., railways are less of a transportation option than it is for others, like in Europe and all of that. And I know that some of these sort of data could seem sort of a little outdated, but I think it's an indicator that people are able to live and have better facilities available to them to live better lives. When some of the other things that we found is that on a daily basis, people in non-market societies have higher caloric intake. So in generally speaking, we just are healthier and we're happier and we're able to live better lives through markets.
But are we more moral? It seems like there's some natural experiments that could be run to test morality. I mean, there's some of these studies like dropping a wallet and seeing if people return it kind of thing. But there have been some natural experiments in recent years, for example, pre-Soviet Poland and post-Soviet Poland, North Korea and South Korea are relatively recently split. Now, it might be hard to go gather empirical data in North Korea. There are a lot of North Koreans, though, actually, who defected or are in South Korea. So, do we have data where we can actually say, does this person, aside from being caloric intake and being able to travel more and have a better life, are they better people? Or if not better, worse, not worse, at least.
Yeah, so there's some a couple of things that I could say to that. First, we looked at a couple of survey measures that got at satisfaction in life of the particular people in different countries. And in terms of the proportion of people who reported to have to be satisfied with their lives, and the number of people who indicated that on a scale of 1 to 10, that they are quite satisfied with their lives. A lot more people for both measures in market societies that they're more satisfied with life than others. Now, the difficulty with using data, as all anyone who works with data can say, is we're able to take a look at virtue-like behaviors and behaviors that suggest things about of people's inners or dispositions and all of that. It's incredibly hard for data to genuinely get at virtue, which is why we took a really wide and broad approach when it came to the empirical sections in our book. We knew that looking at the data, especially when it came to looking at virtue and vices, that there's not going to be one measure that that would solve everything. I mean, it would have certainly made our life so much easier if there was this one data that did everything, but it doesn't. And we get that some of the data, the variables that we look at, is not going to be satisfactory. But when we look at all of the data across the board together, granted, one of them is not going to be satisfactory. It's certainly not going to be getting at sort of the thrust of our argument. But when you look at the data as a whole, it suggests something about people in market societies that critics of markets completely said that shouldn't be happening. In fact, and if the critics were right, we should be seeing a lot of other things happening on a daily basis. For instance, when we go to coffee shops and all, we shouldn't see people just standing in line. Actually, funny thing happened over the pandemic. So one of my local Starbucks, actually the one on campus, has like a set of ropes that helps sort of manage the really long queues that can happen between breaks and all of that. And over the pandemic, they got rid of it, but the sticker on the floor remained. Hilariously, I was the only person who was in that Starbucks that day, but I noticed myself following the stickers. There's no ropes or anything, but here I am just following the sticker. And I, the reason why I noticed is because when I saw another student come in, a one sole student, like I also saw that students were following the lines. And I think that, you know, like those are sort of incredible sort of daily experiences that says something about the people that live in societies. And we just need to, you know, also sort of think of that as we're looking at everything. And I don't mean to say like, let's, I'm not suggesting that we be biased, or I'm not suggesting that we look at cherry pick our data as we think about the narrative. But, and when we look at, again, the entire data across the board together, it suggests something about the people who live in those societies.
One of the things we think of rightfully as a virtue is charity. And you do talk about the difference in charity between market and non-market societies. What does the data show there?
Yeah, the data that we looked at, there's to my recollection, there's a couple of variables that are associated with donations. But the two that we looked at was the proportion of people who reported saying that they had donated or volunteered in the last month, and we looked at, if I remember correctly, the amount of donation that they provided. And in both cases, those who live in market societies donated and or volunteered more frequently, at least in the last month, and also donated more money in the last month than those who lived in non-market societies. And one of the things that I think is really, really great about it is, yes, it's true that one of the things that you could say is people in market societies just have more money, so therefore they're allowed to give more. Like, that seems like an unfair sort of thing to put against people of other countries who have less to spare and all of that. But I think that material improvement has moral consequences. And one of the things that we're able to do as a result of being wealthier, being more prosperous, is that we can actually take care of other people. And we seem to have more interest in taking care of others as well, according to one of the measures that we looked at.
Do we know anything about the difference between the quote-unquote rich, putting that a big quote, relatively quote rich? Because, I mean, especially now, recent years, we've been having a lot of discussion of the 1% and these people who sometimes are presumed to be a little more than like Scrooge McDuck or the Monopoly Man, just, you know, the classic image of the rapacious capitalist. And there is a story that you get told a lot by Hollywood movies about the very, very happy poor man and the very, very miserable rich man. Is there any reason to believe that there's a difference between, I mean, the morality of those people between relatively poor and relatively rich people?
I think, I certainly can't speak to the morality of different people, but there's one thing that that I think I could sort of mention, which is that I think bad apples exist everywhere, right? And I think regardless of what type of institution that we're living in, there's always going to be bad apples. The benefit of living in a market society is that we get to know about the bad apples, whereas in places like the Soviet Union and USSR in the past, when bad apples did rise to the top, they're able to take control and secure their status and secure their reputation and just remain on top and push, keep others down. So I think that The important thing that I want to highlight here is that while bad apples can rise to the top, once they rise to the top in market societies, there we have more ways of punishing them, if you will, if they own companies, if we don't agree with the way the CEO is behaving or the way the CEO has sort of spoken about certain groups of people in the past, recently and things like that. A lot of consumers punish them by boycotting their company, by buying less of their products. Those types of feedback mechanism, types of punishing behavior that that provides feedback for these the rich to sort of change their behavior, moderate their behavior. Those forces don't exist in non-market societies, or rather, I mean non-market here, not in the sense of they're less embracing or anything like that. I mean it as in countries that have very strict institutions that don't allow those kinds of feedback, don't allow those kinds of information to be easily shared.
In the book, you talk about markets, you're not just pushing back on the markets make us worse. That's part of the book. But you also make the positive case. So you move away from this minimalist defense of markets, as you refer to it, and instead say that markets are moral spaces or moral training grounds. What do you mean by that, and how does that impact the way that we should think about being market participants, or the way that we should think about potentially limiting or regulating markets?
One of the things that I think is really unfortunate about the way we talk about markets, and certainly the way we teach what a market is in economics, is that we don't view market actors as human beings who are interacting with one another within a particular space, negotiating their different intensity of desires, and trying to get the things that they want in that space. And when we say that markets are moral spaces and are moralizing spaces, we are precisely referring to all those social interactions that happen in the market. So for instance, when you encounter somebody who's really awesome, who seems to be an honest person, who seems to be trustworthy, reliable, a promise keeper, willing to help one out when they are in a struggle, we want to be friends with them. We want to keep going back to them. We want to continue to interact with them. That's true in a social space. So why wouldn't it be true in the market space as well? And we see that happening, right? Like when there might be a company that charges a little bit more. Like, for instance, I was on the market recently for an HVAC company. And, the HVAC company that I eventually so settled with is not the cheapest. But a lot of their reviews that I've seen of past deals is that they will work with you. They will spend a lot of time explaining to you what's going on. They'll do their best to sort of explain to you what the different options are. And people say, you know, this is the type of the reason why I chose this company and I'm continuing to work with this HVAC company is because they were great. They were human beings who knew that I had constraints, and they worked with my constraints, and we worked it out. And that's so important in the market space as well. Like, we don't always just go for the cheapest things. I'm not, you know, again, sort of dismissing that there are times that we go for the cheapest thing. You're like, and that will happen. But if we're thinking about a business partner that we want to enter a contract with, or if we're thinking about signing a contract with a landlord or something like that. We want to be working with people who are enjoyable to work with, who are reliable. And that's what we mean when we talk about the market being a moralizing space. Those are the particular things that are happening. And if you encounter a bad apple, again, if you encounter a person who cheats their business partners left and right, and they have this particular reputation, we know that they're not going to have, they might be able to get new business partners that they're able to sort of deceive into working with them maybe. But for those who have already had experiences with them, it's unlikely that they will return back to that business partner. And as a result, that dishonest market actor is going to have to change their behavior. It's going to, in order to survive in that environment.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayres. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at libertarianism.org.